say. And
then are you calling me names?
Then an effective tool spoke out.
Right,
so
thank you.
You'll enjoy the decades of great music with R&R. We can't.
KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media. We discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
And it's that time again. There is an election on May 9th, the last date to register. Yeah, yay! But, you know, only if you go out and vote. Last day to register for this election is April 6th, so that would be Thursday. And, you know, on the webpage, we've got all this stuff about harrisvotes.com and votetexas.gov, and there are all kinds of ways to register. But since we're like getting within 24 hours of the deadline, if you're not registered or if you must re-register, you might want to see how quickly you need to get the information in there. Okay. This is going to be a little unusual for us because we've got a couple, three stories that actually are ours. We didn't like excerpt them and stuff. So the first one is what I'm calling the Republican elephant in the room. Any regular listeners to this show know that I hate discussing news that is fully covered, or especially news that is ridiculously overcovered on this show. But the Trump indictments and the accompanying booking process circus require some mention and discussion here. You know, just can't avoid it. One of the things that has really bugged me is the failure to take a mugshot. Trump voluntarily turned himself in, so I can understand not being handcuffed or perp walked into the courthouse. But getting a mugshot is like a rite of passage for those being booked. Lots of famous people, many of whom are instantly recognizable by most folks, have had mugshots taken. One reason being given for not taking a mugshot is the security complications. To me, I don't see how security would be any more complicated than Trump walking into the courthouse or into the courtroom, so I don't buy that. Another reason being given is that Trump may be the most recognizable man in the world, but plenty of very recognizable people, high-profile politicians and movie stars, for example, have still gone through the mugshot ritual. You don't want to see Nick Nolte's mugshot, and I'm sure he doesn't either. I have another theory. I think it was a condition negotiated by Trump's lawyers in order to get him to Manhattan from Florida without an extradition fight. The reasons are otherwise unclear. True, the Trump grift machine was all set to put his mugshot on T-shirts, banners, and even, yes, mugs. And some say that Trump was relishing the opportunity to smile for his mugshot, figuring it would be a donation moneymaker. Maybe this is one time Trump listened to his lawyers and smarter political advisors, but the get out of Florida free theory is kind of what works for me. Andrew?
I think there are a lot of people who would appreciate a get out of Florida free card. yes, I feel very similarly about the fact that we didn't get to see Trump in handcuffs. I tell you, I'd be laughing at that image for the rest of my life. Though, in fairness, we did get a pretty good court sketch. The man looks like the Grinch. It's hours of fun. Seriously, though, you're right that any image of Trump being treated like any other person who breaks the law in this country would have been jumped on for merchandising and political advertising immediately. Trump's lawyers, or possibly his PR people, must have thought that having images of their client in handcuffs or his mugshot circulating would really harm their case and or his image. It's the only reason I can think of that his campaign team would let this opportunity pass them by.
The irony of a mugshot ruining someone's image.
I know.
Redundant.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. This is a legitimate question.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had read that under the conditions of his appearance, he not only would not get the mugshot taken, but that he also would not give a DNA sample. I've read other people's comments that, yes, that's part of the normal booking process, and normally he would not have to be asked to give one. He would give one.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I'm unclear whether he gave a DNA sample or not. Do you have any idea?
No. You've been following this a lot closer than I have, because I tend to avoid political circuses like this. But except when we talk about it on this show.
Yeah, well.
But yeah, I don't know anything about that. It would not surprise me if he hadn't given one, again, for the same reasons that he hasn't been treated like a regular prisoner, because he's a VIP prisoner. But yeah, I haven't heard anything.
I will have to dig into that a little further, because I'm getting a little conflicted information on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next story, which is, again, you know, something that we came up with.
Our next item for discussion.
Our next item for discussion, which is a story.
Okay, fair enough.
Highway traffic is supposed to have the right of way when exiting what is called a controlled access highway. Why are there no yield signs for frontage road traffic? And I've been thinking of this repeatedly as I've been exiting controlled highways. Hmm. Page 21, I actually looked this up and I've accessed a link for you. Page 21 of the 2023 Texas Driving Test Manual states this, quote, "The driver traveling on the frontage road of a controlled access highway must yield the right of way to a vehicle that's, one, entering or about to enter the frontage road from the highway, or two, leaving or about to leave the frontage road to enter the highway." Now, this is such a crucial rule. I don't know why no yield signs are posted on frontage roads. This yield rule should also apply when exiting traffic needs to cross lanes quickly upon exiting, which happens a lot. This is nearly impossible to do in the absence of yield signs for drivers on the frontage road. A few weeks ago, there was a mini tempest in Houston City Council about the need to redo road striping around the city. Mm-hmm. In my humble opinion, getting these yield signs installed is really no less important, and I don't understand their total absence. Andrew? Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a good point, and honestly, it's a rule that I couldn't recall until you brought it up, though I'm sure that it was covered in my driver's ed course. I probably just don't remember it. I suspect it has something to do with funding, as many administrative issues like signage and such do in Texas especially. If our listeners want something to do after the show, maybe they could play Internet Detective and see if any studies have been done on whether yield signs on frontage roads are helpful enough to warrant the cost. Y'all know how to get in touch with us, and if you don't, you will soon.
I guess the thing that strikes me is they've obviously never been there. There aren't like posts that don't have signs on them. So even when they were building these highways and spending millions of dollars per mile and, you know, putting up all the grade separations and whatnot, the signs were never there.
Well, it could just be as simple as nobody ever thought to do it. Nobody ever thought it would be needed, or nobody ever made the connection between, oh, there's this yield rule on the frontage roads, and maybe we should be reminding people of that. It, you know, just stuff like that gets overlooked all the time, especially in big projects.
Well, if you ever get into an accident with a car exiting a controlled access highway, just remember, you will automatically be in the wrong, just like rear-ending somebody.
Yeah.
Okay, our next story, if you will, it's you know, something we just kind of decided to talk about. And I've titled it "To the Fed, All They Have Is a Hammer, So the Whole Economy Looks Like a Nail." Rather than use the blunt tool of interest rate hikes, why doesn't the Fed develop focused tools to increase production where shortages are causing inflation? In a March 7th hearing, Senator Elizabeth Warren questioned Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell about the Fed's strategy for cooling inflation, pointing out that rapid rate increases could throw 2 million people out of work as the price of lower inflation. Powell did not disagree, but considered it a necessary trade-off. And by the way, I've actually linked to a video of that exchange. And their discussion got me thinking. Inflation is basically described, and I mean basically because I'm not an economist, as too many dollars chasing too few goods or services. So perhaps the Fed has a hammer problem. You know, the old saying, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Maybe it's time for the Fed and economists everywhere to question this method of taming inflation. I don't specifically have the answer, but here's the idea that I think should guide whatever solution is found. Find a way to target the areas of shortage in order to balance supply and demand. In an era of normal interest rates, which is actually about where we are now historically, perhaps rate reductions could be aimed specifically at business sectors that need to produce more, or perhaps applied to industries that need to use those supplies with greater efficiency in order to reduce demand, thus cooling inflation in those sectors. Now, admittedly, I suffer from a lack of imagination here, but I think the basic notion of targeting sectors to balance supply and demand rather than the blunt tool of hammering the entire economy to achieve a hoped-for outcome is a concept worth pursuing. I just thought I'd throw the idea out there, Andrew.
A lack of imagination in politics? Never heard of it. You know, we actually talked a bit about this before on our show from October 19th of 2022, which you can hear on the blog at thinkwingradio.com. In that show, I proposed my own alternative of price controls, but I like where Mike is going here. Targeted action on specific economic sectors rather than wide-ranging policy changes certainly sounds like a smarter approach. In that spirit, when prices are reasonable but there aren't enough goods being produced to meet demand, it actually might be worth reducing taxes on businesses specifically in the sectors that need to churn out more supply. Not income taxes for executives or speculation taxes on investors, if that becomes a thing, leaving those alone, but just reducing the amount of tax that the businesses as entities have to pay. Now, my thinking here is that this could make it more attractive to start new businesses in those sectors and give existing businesses more revenue to hopefully invest in increasing production while limiting the impact on tax revenue for social services. Any slack would be picked up by income and speculation taxes and keeping business taxes the same outside of those very specific industries. Sure, it's not, you know, restructuring society to ensure everyone gets what they need to survive, but it'd probably harm fewer working people than the current playbook, meaning more folks have the energy to help the work along. Now, the trick would be ensuring that these tax reductions are temporary, because donors to both major parties would probably quite like them to be made permanent.
I will point out here that when you talk about business taxes, that's actually a much broader category than most people think. You know, most people think of business taxes as income taxes paid by businesses, corporate income tax.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are investment tax credits, there's depreciation deductions, there's all kinds of different ways that you can stimulate investments to either increase productivity or increase efficiency.
And this is all stuff
relate directly to profits.
Yeah, and this is all stuff that affects like the organizations and the companies, not even necessarily the people in them directly, right?
Well, and I think the best part of, let's say, having changes, let's say, in investment tax credits and depreciation, which has been done before, is that it helps the company without profiting any one individual in the company.
Right.
And it helps the economy because efficiency is generally good. And it would be nice if that was occasionally shared with the workers, because increases in efficiency and productivity have not been passing down to workers for the most part for the last 40 years.
That's true. I mean, I don't think that they do it out of the goodness of their own heart. I don't think that I would expect the results of this policy to be an increase in, you know, the average wage in the U.S. But I do think that there's an opportunity here for this kind of you know, new business opening or expansion of existing business under this idea to create new jobs so that there can be more people who are, you know, gainfully employed, and that helps out the economy as well. You know, it's within the existing, you know, capitalist framework. And I know that there are going to be some people on the left who criticize it from that position. That's fair. But I'm not saying it's a magic solution. I'm not saying it's a deep solution. I'm saying it's something that can buy us more time to figure out something better, I guess.
And I think that if this was the direction that the reforms would go in, they would have to be very scalpel-like.
Yes, absolutely.
And, of course, that is always the challenge whenever you're doing legislation or stuff like that.
Yep.
Anyway, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. Download it with Google Podcasts, available from the Android or iPhone app stores, and I recommend that. Or you can go to archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this show and over 100 other KPFT programs. Every story on this show is heavily excerpted, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click on show posts and more at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and look for me on Twitter. Yeah, you can still look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. You can find me at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's Dominate, E-Y-E, on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Okay, enough of our crazy ideas. Let's get to some news stories. The first one is from CommunityImpact.com. Maple Ridge Street in Bel Air to remain open after sale withdrawn for section through the Bel Air Triangle. Bel Air City Council is no longer proceeding with the potential sale of a portion of Maple Ridge Street in a deal that would have closed the street to vehicular traffic in order to expand one of the first shopping centers in the city. The announcement was made during the public comments portion of the April 3rd City Council meeting, according to Mayor Andrew Friedberg. The developers interested in acquiring the land, initially for a $1 agreement, did not meet the city's extended deadline. The mayor said that the city council will not be considering the matter any further. FYI, the story from Community Impact includes a Google map of the area in question. The section of Maple Ridge that was up for sale, and I would put that in quotation marks because $1 is just a technicality for a legal transfer of ownership. A $1 sale, very often in personal transactions, the $1 isn't actually even given. But this is a short one-block stretch that lies between Bissonnette Street and Bel Air Boulevard. If someone is leaving the triangle and needs to go to one road or the other, that may not be too bad. But actually transiting that small section of road to cross both is probably a real safety hazard. In principle, I am against closing streets for private advantage at the expense of commuters and travelers. They did that in Lower Manhattan when they built the World Trade Center, and it really screwed traffic in that area, and it was already pretty screwed. It's worth noting that when the new Freedom Tower was built, they added pass-throughs and reopened streets. I think a better idea in this instance would be to just turn that street into a short pedestrian mall. Maybe the city could even rent some space to vendor carts and generate some revenue that way, as well as adding some welcoming atmosphere. It might be an asset to businesses in the triangle, and it would end two dangerous traffic intersections. And as Andrew often says, more pedestrian spaces are good things. Andrew?
Huh. I guess that ventriloquist class I took wasn't bunk after all. Because my words just came out of Mike's mouth.
Well, in a world where Andrew proposes business tax cuts, anything is possible.
I suppose so. Yeah, I think that's a great idea, Mike. I'm not familiar with the area because I don't leave my house, but I can certainly imagine the danger from a street connecting to two very busy thoroughfares like that. I think pedestrianizing this street is a real opportunity for Bel Air to make this section of its city safer to live, work, and shop in, and I hope a local resident proposes it to the city council before the matter is totally forgotten about. Whether they credit ThinkWing for the idea or not is their call.
Our next story is from Texas Tribune, and this is a long story that, you know, I always struggle to cut those down in the excerpts. We'll see how I do. The Texas Senate votes to defund libraries where drag queens read to kids as it tries to limit the performances kids can attend. The Senate expanded the bill targeting drag queen story hours before two Democrats joined Republicans in advancing it. The upper chamber also gave preliminary approval to a bill limiting other drag performances kids can see. And the story goes, for months, Texas senators have said their bills targeting drag shows are meant to protect children from sexually explicit performances. Some Democrats' drag performances and performers and businesses catering to LGBTQ Texans have fiercely pushed back against the implication that all drag performances are inherently sexual. They've also said some bills restrict free expression enshrined in the First Amendment, as they've testified against bills in legislative hearings and rallied in opposition at the Texas Capitol. And bill opponents say the Republican proposals are helping to fuel an overall backlash against drag, as performers have increasingly seen protests and threats coordinated against them by activists and extremist groups. Austin-based drag performer Bridget Bandit told the Texas Tribune last month, "We just need to understand that drag is not inherently sexual, and queer expression is not inherently sexual." Amid some of the criticism, Republican Senator Brian Hughes of Mineola, who was the architect of some of Texas's most conservative legislation in 2021, narrowed his legislative push to restrict drag shows, and on Tuesday, he secured initial Senate approval for his Senate Bill 12, which bars kids from drag shows only if the performances are overly lewd and lascivious. But moments later, the Senate also preliminarily voted 20-9 from the chamber floor to defund public libraries where drag queens are allowed to read to children. And Senate Bill 1601 does not tie its financial penalties to the performer's behavior and essentially targets all libraries' drag queen story hours, which are aimed at promoting literacy and encouraging children to read. I know this gets very confusing with all the Senate bill and House bill numbers, but here we are. Hughes didn't explicitly say what SB 1601 would protect kids from. Instead, during the bill's Senate and committee debates, he brought up an example of the House of the Houston Public Library hosting a registered sex offender as one of its Storytime program's drag queens because the library didn't do a background check as evidence for backing the bill. On the other hand, drag performers and their allies pointed out during the bill's committee hearing that kids are more likely to be harmed by gun violence or sexual abuse perpetrated by church members. Senator Royce West of Dallas is the only Democrat to approve SB 1601. Democrat Juan Chuy Hinojosa of McAllen voted in support of the measure from the Senate floor, but later said he actually opposes it and will be switching his vote. Lawmakers, most of whom are Republicans, are pushing a bevy of bills during this legislative session that threaten to upend the lives of many LGBTQ Texans. The Senate last week approved a bill that would prohibit transgender kids from updating their birth certificates so that it matches their gender. GOP lawmakers want to limit classroom instruction, school activities, and teacher guidance about sexual orientation and gender identity in schools. And also on Tuesday, the Senate gave final approval to a proposed ban on transgender kids accessing puberty blockers and hormone therapy. And by the way, puberty blockers are not just for transgender kids. Republican Senator Drew Springer of Minster, successfully broadened SB 1601 to bar libraries from receiving any public money the year following any events in which drag performers read to kids. This means facilities violating the proposed restriction could lose revenue streams from their local governments, a crucial part of their budgets. I'll let Andrew address that later. SB 12 is more narrow when compared to other Republican proposals for restricting drag shows. For instance, Hughes's other proposal, Senate Bill 476, defines drag shows more broadly as individuals wearing outfits or makeup that indicated gender different from their gender assigned at birth while performing in front of an audience for entertainment. This wider definition could have covered activities unrelated to drag, such as a transgender person singing karaoke with friends in a bar, for example, or an actor wearing a costume as part of a Shakespeare play that involves wearing clothes traditionally associated with a different gender. That was typical, by the way, in Shakespeare's time. Drag performers insist that SB 12 is an attack on their First Amendment rights and say the bill's language is imprecise, opening it up to multiple interpretations. I suspect that that's a feature, not a bug. During the Tuesday Senate debate, some Democratic lawmakers also characterized the bill as, quote, overly broad. Austin-based drag performer Lori Bird told the Tribune last month the language in the bill is so purposefully vague that it could encapsulate many forms of queer art and try to shut them down. The bill's opponents added that it would harm restaurants and bars that use drag shows to draw in more customers or charities that host these performances as fundraisers. The measure could particularly impact businesses owned by LGBTQ Texans, they said. As bills focused on the LGBTQ community have moved through the legislature this year, drag performers, transgender Texans, and community advocates have also questioned the sincerity of lawmakers' claims that they're trying to protect children. Many say legislators are further stigmatizing people. I've had shows canceled. We've had people show up with guns. That's more terrifying to kids than me looking like this right now, said Bandit last month, while donned in a bright pink floor-length gown and a big pink wig inside the Texas Capitol. There's a lot more to this article, so you might want to click on the link I provide and read it for yourself. Mm. While going over this story, remember that modern conservatives generally, and Texas conservatives especially, are still supposed to be all for local control and personal freedom, except, you know, when they're not. Which is any time they have other ideas about local control and personal freedom. Mm. FYI, in researching my comments here, I learned that the First Amendment, and I didn't know this, is so strong that it's not illegal to yell fire in a crowded theater, and I've provided references for that. Huh. Now, there may be other consequences, like civil suits by anyone injured as a result, but it's not illegal. Further, from a strictly technical point of view, I don't know that there is any law requiring the state of Texas to fund libraries, so I suppose they could withdraw their funding if they don't like what the libraries are doing. The federal government uses that same logic as a club against discriminatory policies by schools and universities that receive federal funding. But these various state laws would not prevent local governments and private donors from funding public libraries and preserving free speech. Of course, the so-called freedom-loving conservatives in Austin have also hobbled local ability to raise taxes by whatever means localities find necessary and suitable. They've outlawed income taxes and also capped property taxes. On a local level, there aren't many other options. I guess what this all comes down to is that elections have consequences. Mm-hmm. That is why I start almost every show with a reminder to be registered to vote and to vote. Because real freedom starts with each one of us at the polls. Andrew?
Well, yeah, just because the Texas state government could withdraw their funding to libraries doesn't mean they should. And I, of course, know you know this, but I feel it's worth repeating. Yeah, I'm deeply disappointed in Royce West.
Well, they're banning books. And, the simplest way to ban books is just to close libraries. That just solves that problem.
Yeah. I'm deeply disappointed in Royce West, the Democrat from Dallas, who was the one Democrat who solidly supported this bill against drag shows and libraries. I dare say this might be enough to get some Democratic voters in Dallas looking at their third party options on the ballot. I really hope that Senator West reconsiders his vote like Juan Hinojosa did. I also noted that the article said the bill would, in fact, prevent libraries that host drag performers from receiving local government funds as well as state government funds. But after pulling up the bill's text, which is linked on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com, the bill's text is really short, as a lot of these base-pleasing bills tend to be, it does actually specify state funding would be prohibited. Now, this is an unfortunate error in the article and may have caused slightly more concern than is needed. But it's still a bad bill, still an example of Republican hypocrisy. They don't care, but voters should. And could absolutely sink libraries in low-income areas of the state.
I have to say, Andrew, between the two of us, we actually get a fair amount of collaborating research or corroborating, rather, research done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I'm kind of pleased. Okay, this is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, Houston's community media, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. You can download it with Google Podcasts, available from Android and iPhone app stores, or you can visit archive.kpft.org for previous versions of this and over 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and to do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for Think Wing Radio, eventually I'll learn how to pronounce that name, by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, perhaps the one I have trouble pronouncing, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift. And tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Okay, our next story is from the Texas Tribune, jointly reported with VoteBeat. Texas may be about to scrap a voting security system it can't replace. It took years to build the multi-state system known as ERIC, which weeds out duplicate, deceased, and suspicious voter registrations. Texas Republicans want to dump it, but there's no viable alternative. With some Texas Republicans pushing the state to abandon one of its best tools for preventing voter fraud, a coalition of states that share voting roll data to weed out duplicate and suspicious registrations, the Secretary of State's office, that is the Texas one, is trying to discern if it can build a replacement. But the effort could easily stall or take years, experts say. Similar efforts in other states over the past two decades have not worked or have been shut down because they lacked bipartisan support from multiple states and access to the kind of national data that produces accurate crossover voter list matching, all of which the Electronic Information Registration Center, or ERIC, spent years developing. The push to have Texas become the latest state to withdraw from ERIC, a long-standing effort by nearly 30 states, is rooted in a year-long misinformation campaign that spread through right-wing media platforms and advocacy groups. If the state decides to leave the program but fails to produce a similar tool, Texas voter rolls will inevitably be less accurate, which could fuel claims of voter fraud, experts say. That could increase costs for counties who'd be more likely to send election mailers and to voters who moved out of state or died, because outdated information would linger on the voter rolls. And the state, too, would spend more than it would save by leaving the program because it would need to build the technical infrastructure and meet the federal security requirements needed to protect sensitive data in order to make an alternative viable. Sam Taylor, a spokesperson for the Texas Secretary of State's office, declined to comment on the feasibility of developing a new alternative to ERIC. He should try just designing a video game, for starters. He told VoteBeat, however, that at least Georgia and Nevada, states that are currently members of ERIC and supportive of the program, as well as Oklahoma, have expressed interest in working with Texas on the project. Taylor said research is also underway on the cost of developing such a system. In no small part, experts note, the coalition ERIC built over many years worked because member states, led by both Democrats and Republicans, agreed to come together in a good faith effort to share the necessary data and information to help maintain voter rolls across state lines. But in recent months, political pressure on Republican-led states has left the coalition at risk. Last year, Louisiana, then Alabama, followed by Florida, West Virginia, Missouri, and most recently Ohio and Iowa, announced they would depart. Texas could be next. The Texas legislature is already considering various bills to leave ERIC. The state's attempt at replacing the program both would not be an efficient solution and could have implications for the states that remain in ERIC by making it harder for states to join together across party lines, said Mark Meredith, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and an expert on election administration who has also done research on voter list maintenance. Meredith said, "It would be incredibly disappointing to end up with basically two versions of the same thing, because the value of data grows exponentially as you can make more and more comparisons between states." Meredith added that by leaving the program, Texas will deprive itself of all the other states' data while preventing the other states from obtaining data on the more than 16 million registered voters in the state. It's not like if you split the world and have 25 states in one program and 25 states in another, it would be equally good, Meredith said. It's actually more than double the bad. As usual, this is an excerpt. There is much more detail in this story. This is just another example of right-wing hypocrisy. If they're really so concerned about voter fraud, why scrap something that works with no viable replacement in sight? If they think they can design something better, the usual policy would be to design it and then run the two systems side by side for several years to compare results. I mean, maybe ERIC can be improved, but that assumes they're acting in good faith. I would question that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
FYI, there is another section subtitled "Past Efforts to Cross-Check Voter Rolls Without ERIC Have Failed," worth noting. Andrew?
Well, I think I know exactly why Republicans in Texas and the other states are doing this. I'm speculating, but I think it's pretty informed speculation. Republicans are taking states out of ERIC to create more opportunity for voter fraud, which, regardless of if it actually happens or not, Republicans can use as further justification to pass more restrictive voter requirements. These new requirements are specifically designed to be difficult for low-income people and black people to be able to satisfy. These groups tend not to vote Republican, so by passing laws that make it more, that make it harder for them to vote, Republicans pave the way to win more elections. In many ways, it's tantamount to Hitler's 1933 Enabling Act. It's the same strategy of consolidating control of government. It's despicable.
And, you know, because Andrew brought up the Enabling Act, which I didn't know the name. I knew some of the processes when Hitler was consolidating control of Germany.
Yes.
So I have added a link to the Enabling Act by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Brief summary, the Enabling Act allowed the Reich government to issue laws without the consent of Germany's parliament, laying the foundation for the complete Nazification of German society. The law was passed on March 23, 1933, and published the following day. Its full technical name was Law to Remedy the Distress of the People and the Reich. And we all know how, you know, public-spirited that was. Okay, next story is from the Associated Press via click2houston.com. North Carolina lawmaker signals party switch with big impact. Speculation is rising in the North Carolina legislature that a Democrat, Representative Tricia Cotham of Mecklenburg County, is about to switch parties and give Republicans a complete veto-proof majority in the General Assembly, a move that could affect legislation on immigration, abortion, and voting, among others. If the Democrat does switch parties, it would be a major political setback for Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and allies in their attempts to block conservative initiatives during the governor's final 2 years in office. It could make it easier for Republicans to enact bills that would force, for example, sheriffs to cooperate with federal immigration agents and prevent counting absentee ballots after Election Day. The GOP is also debating if and how to make further restrictions on abortion. The story goes into rather more detail, but leaves out what I think is a crucial element. Cotham was just elected last year and took office on January 1st of this year. She ran against three other Democrats and won by just a plurality of under 48%. For her to run as a Democrat and switch parties, if that's what will happen, 3 months after taking office, is classic false advertising. She must have known this was the plan. This is more proof that elections require runoffs, or at the least, or ranked choice voting. More than half of voters didn't want her to win, so this is a real slap in the face to her district. Andrew?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In a functioning democracy, half and bait and switches like this would either be much more difficult or impossible, depending on whether you prefer voting for candidates or parties to hold seats. Ranked choice voting works in both cases, and it ensures that the winner or winners of an election are actually supported by a majority of the electorate. So even if a party switch happened under RCV, it's far less, it's far more likely to be a possibility that the electorate considered and was okay with.
Our next story is from CNN.com from March 26th, how U.S. troops in Germany are training Ukrainians to save one another on the battlefield. For U.S. troops, the training is nothing new. Applying tourniquets, clearing someone's airway, recognizing signs of traumatic brain injuries. But to the Ukrainian troops receiving it, the training is literally a matter of life or death on the battlefield in the war against Russia. U.S. troops have been providing critical medical instruction and combat casualty care to Ukrainians at Grafenwehr training area in Germany for almost a year, in between other significant training on weapon systems. And while it may not be as high profile as that in tanks, Patriot missile systems, or combined arms tactics, it could literally have an even more immediate impact on the battlefield. Just knowing and keeping in the back of our minds that everything we were doing and saying would have that direct impact on their ability to save lives and to save each other and to prolong their lives during their fight for their country, it definitely is going to, I think, stick with us for the rest of our lives, said Sergeant Alexis Ballard, a combat medic who helped start the medical training program in Germany. Ballard and Captain Christina Whitler, the Field Artillery Squadron Physician Assistant, were among the medics on site last May as Ukrainians were training on M777 howitzers. It's typical for medics to be present at a range during training and hoping to be as useful as possible. Whitler told CNN she spoke with a Ukrainian leader on the ground to see what else they might need. The answer was clear: more medical training. In many cases, the soldiers making up Ukraine's military are everyday citizens with no military or medical background. First Lieutenant Christiana McCarthy, a medical operations officer with the New York National Guard, who's currently conducting the training in Germany, told CNN that they have people, quote, who worked in hospitals for years before the war, working side by side with somebody who was a physical education teacher. Indeed, Whitler said when they began the lesson, some Ukrainians had already been trained by U.S. soldiers previously, while others were brand new to the military because of the current situation in Ukraine. Combat medical training couldn't be more crucial. As of November last year, roughly 100,000 Ukrainian troops were believed to have been killed or wounded since Russia's invasion began in February of 2022. The Ukrainian government doesn't release those numbers, so those are estimates. There's no end to the war in sight. The training is similar in many ways to what U.S. soldiers get, but unlike those U.S. troops, the Ukrainians had come straight from a battlefield and were preparing to go back. Oftentimes, Whitler said Ukrainian troops brought up real-world examples they'd experienced in the war raging just miles away. They asked what to do next time if they were to see a similar injury, and in some cases, they asked what could they have done to save a fellow soldier if only they'd known how. Those conversations were hard, Whitler said. And sometimes we just were able to provide some solace that they did everything they could, and even if there was an OR right next to them, a surgeon couldn't have saved them. Two New York National Guard soldiers who are now training Ukrainians told CNN it now includes simulations on mannequins, practicing responding to mass casualty events, and addressing burns and fractures. But it's human-to-human moments that will stick with the Americans long after the mission is over. Ballard said it was clear that many knew they'd soon be going directly back into it, and potentially experiencing some of the same things they were still trying to process. So sometimes Americans were there just to listen, and if nothing else, to reassure them that they're doing an amazing job and that they couldn't have done anything better. Whitler also recalled moments talking to Ukrainian troops who were exhibiting signs of traumatic brain injuries due to Russian artillery impact, symptoms like dizziness, headaches, or just feeling angrier or more irritable. They were frustrated, but Whitler reassured them that what they were experiencing was, unfortunately, normal. I think we did provide a little bit of comfort in that way, she said, that they knew I should be experiencing this and hopefully it will go away. Ballard specifically recalled training the troops on how to use a nasopharyngeal airway, which is a thin tube inserted through a patient's nose to open up their airway. Ballard said, we would ask for a volunteer, and of course one of the older gentlemen would throw up one of the younger gentlemen to go up. Everybody would gather around as closely as they could and watch as they inserted the tube into the soldier's nose. Hearing people's reactions, it's the same way that all the soldiers I've taught have reacted. But watching them do it was absolutely hilarious, she said, and was just one of those bonding moments to have with them I think is definitely going to stick with me. Those moments made it all the more difficult to see them leave at the end of their training. Whitler and Ballard recalled a graduation ceremony for their Ukrainian partners to acknowledge all they'd learned and done. It was very emotional, Ballard said. They're fighting for their lives, Ballard said, and they're fighting for their home, and the absolute least we can do is try to help them. For me, there's really nothing I can add here as a comment except to try and imagine what it must be like to be Ukrainian, having to go through this, and how basic their needs for assistance can be after you talk about anti-aircraft and tanks and artillery shells and stuff. This is really basic stuff. Literally, how do you stop the bleeding? Andrew?
Before we get into my comment, which I'll warn everybody is long, would we like to take a break? I think it might be a good time.
I think we're okay.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take a little bit of a harder look at this article because to me, it reminds me a lot of news media that was sort of accused in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq of manufacturing consent. It seems somewhat of a propaganda piece. I think that this article is most useful as a media analysis exercise. What is the purpose of this article? Who benefits from that purpose and how? What messages might it contain? And which of those messages are obvious, and which ones are less obvious? My answers to those questions The purpose of the article is to humanize the Ukrainian and U.S. soldiers involved in the war in Ukraine. The U.S. and Ukrainian militaries benefit most directly, because by humanizing the soldiers involved, the audience is more likely to sympathize with them. If the audience is a member of the public, they might write to their representatives or speak to other people they know in support of the Ukrainian military and the U.S.'s aid to Ukraine. If the audience is an elected official, they might make decisions that increase funding to both militaries. And of course, when a military benefits, its government does too. The article's obvious messages are that the Ukrainians are on the right side of the conflict, and that the U.S. troops are doing a good thing by teaching Ukrainians these medical skills. The less obvious messages are that the war should end as quickly as possible. The emphasis on the death toll and the fact that many Ukrainian combatants have no military background is a good indicator of that. But also that peace efforts shouldn't be taken seriously. From the article, "There's no end to the war in sight." Now, do I disagree with those messages? Not all of them, and not entirely. But I think it's important to be able to read between the lines and judge the truth for yourself in all news stories, and especially for stories like this, that cover some aspect of war in a positive light, no matter how justified the cause is. This is because just causes can quickly become excuses for atrocity, and the best way to prevent that from happening is to be able to recognize it and argue against it. Examining stories like this closely is a good way to start.
I actually think that Andrew's suggestion that this is, in fact, a sort of a propaganda puff piece, you want to be sympathetic. And, I mean, you can be sympathetic at the same time as that it's kind of a propaganda puff piece. I think Andrew's being a little hard on it. I think there are other war-related stories that maybe could have used this kind of deconstruction, if you will. I think one of the things to consider here, and we do have one more story to get to, but I think one of the things to consider here is this is as close as the modern era gets to a white hat, black hat war. I mean, you have a country that was not heavily militarized. I think their entire defense budget before the war was, you know, Ukraine, $500 million. I think about $500 million was their total defense budget. And then you had Russia, who has like three times their population and spends maybe 10 times as much on their military budget. First in 2014, taking Crimea, which in a previous agreement they had agreed was part of legal Ukrainian territory. And then in 2022, they just decide to basically take Ukraine. Now, that hasn't worked out so well for them, but an awful lot of people are dying and being maimed and suffering and starving and freezing. And, you know, an awful lot of Russians aren't doing a lot better. Not as close to actual combat, but life is uncomfortable. You know, Andrew, and correct me if I'm wrong, please. Andrew, I think, is seeing this article as perhaps not advocating for a quick end to the war.
Yes, I believe that's okay. That's a fair characterization, yeah.
Okay. And correct me if I say anything now that you feel misrepresents what you said. I think that when you talk about ending the war, that automatically brings up a necessity or an obligation to say, okay, what would it take to end the war? Would it be freezing the current military lines? Would it be some kind of an armistice? Would it be an agreement to exchange territory for peace? Or from the Ukrainian point of view, hey, you invaded us. We want you to leave Ukraine. And then the only thing left to negotiate after the Russians leave Ukraine is, are there going to be reparations and what kinds? Are there going to be demilitarized zones? Are there going to be limits on border military presence? I mean, these are all things that can be negotiated, but the first thing has to be something that both countries agree to, and Russia is not going to agree to completely withdraw from Ukraine. I think this is one of those situations where this war will end, or end temporarily, when either one side has an insurmountable advantage, or both sides are too exhausted to continue and a ceasefire for some period of time. Remember, the Korean War is still technically a ceasefire. I don't see this war ending without Ukraine recovering all its territory, because anything else rewards the Russians. Now, from a Russian standpoint, they've sacrificed so much, their attitude may be, we have to come away with some territory or this was all for nothing, especially if we even have to give back Crimea. But from the Ukrainian point of view, and I think from the Western point of view, given 20th century history, anything else constitutes a victory for a territorial aggressor. So, go ahead.
I think that Mike and I think that anybody who listens to this show will, you know, regularly will know this. Mike and I have fundamentally differing views on what constitutes victory and defeat in war. Obviously there are, you know, there is military victory, there is military defeat, but I think that Mike takes the view that reverting to the status quo before the war happened, I think Mike takes the view that most military leaders tend to see that as a defeat. I don't take that view. To me, a status quo is a neutral outcome. It is not good because both sides have exhausted military capability and this sort of thing, but it's not a bad outcome either. And I think when you approach it from that angle, I think it's still viable in this scenario. I especially think that because a major motivator of Russia's invasion was geopolitical. It was NATO expansionism. It's
allegedly
it's driving forces within Russia. You know, driving conservatism within Russia. It's not just about taking territory, although that was a major part of it. Is a major part of it. It's not over yet.
Well, they clearly said they wanted to take over Ukraine.
Just a minute. I was silent during your bit, so just a minute.
Yeah, but your bit is longer.
Not so far. Basically, in order to try and bring this to a close so we can do the final break, I think that even in the most just wars, even in the most unquestioningly, we are in the right and this is the right thing to do, there needs to be an element of every society that participates in a war that says, we are here to make sure that this does not go overboard, because it can go overboard. It can very easily go overboard. Even in the most justified of circumstances, that can happen, and it has happened. And if nobody fills the role that we are filling, it will happen again.
Well, so, a lot of countries learn that getting into a war is a lot easier than getting out. The United States has learned it. The UK has learned it. France has learned it. And by golly, Russia's learning it. I think for me, and I'm hoping that you can agree to allow this to be more or less the last word, I think for me, the lesson here is Munich of 1938, when the Western powers gave Germany the German-speaking part of Czechoslovakia called the Sudetenland, which, by the way, was where Czechoslovakia had most of their defenses. And by giving that area to Germany because of the Spanish-speaking people, Czechoslovakia was occupied shortly thereafter. And,
well, I
you know,
can't...
And then the British prime minister came back saying, I've achieved peace in our time. And, of course, a year later, the whole continent was at war.
Well, I can't let that be the last word, because that's an argument that you're trying to make to win. So I will offer what I can hope is the last word, and I hope it can actually be neutral.
Make it as short as mine.
It is important to understand what you are being told, who from, and why they're telling you it.
Yes.
And you need to be able to know those things to determine the truth for yourself.
Yes, I don't disagree with that. Is that it?
That can be it.
Okay, excellent. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. Google Podcasts is a great way to get it. Download from the Android or iPhone app stores, or archive.kpft.org. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. That's not metaphorical, by the way. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-KPFT extension 1. You can send us your thoughts about our show mailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. Go to Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and I am so far still on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, plus Andrew has his stuff.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk socialist politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Okay, we're going to try to get through this last story fairly quickly. It's from the Associated Press, February 7th. 15 million people live under the threat of glacial lake outburst floods, study finds. As glaciers melt and they pour massive amounts of water into nearby lakes, 15 million people across the globe live under the threat of a sudden and deadly outburst flood, a new study finds. More than half of those living in the shadow of the disaster called glacial lake outburst floods are in just four countries: India, Pakistan, Peru, and China, according to a study in Tuesday's Nature Communications. A second study, awaiting publication in a peer-reviewed journal, catalogs more than 150 glacial lake flood outbursts in history and recent times. It's a threat Americans and Europeans rarely think about, but 1 million people live within just 6 miles of potentially unstable glacial-fed lakes, the study calculated. Scientists say so far it doesn't seem like climate change has made those floods more frequent, but as glaciers shrink with warming, the amount of water in the lakes grows, making them more dangerous in those rare situations when dams burst. The trouble is that scientists are focusing too much attention on the Pakistan, India, China, and the Himalayas, often called High Mountain Asia, and somewhat ignoring the Andes, said study co-author Tom Robinson, a disaster risk scientist at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. The second and third highest risk basins are in Peru's Santa Basin and Bolivia's Beni Basin, the paper said. Three lake basins in the United States and Canada rank high for threats, from the Pacific Northwest to Alaska, but aren't nearly as high as areas in Asia and the Andes with few people in the danger zone. They are in Alaska's Kenai Peninsula, distinct from the Mendenhall Glacier near Juneau, northeast Washington State, and west-central British Columbia. Andrew, I think you wanted to say something on this.
Yeah, I wanted to take the lead on this. A while back, I actually sent Mike an obituary for Washington State's Hinman Glacier, which had melted to the point it was no longer considered a glacier in August 2022. As far as I know, this hadn't had any major sudden impact on the bodies of water near it, but it's absolutely a sign that while these floods aren't a risk to the U.S. right now, we're well on our way to it. Even if we weren't, though, it's still not good news. I'm not even sure how folks in these countries are supposed to prepare for this. I wonder if our hurricane preparedness principles here in Texas might be useful for surviving an outburst flood.
Well, if you have the right monitoring equipment on site.
Yeah, and the seawall.
And the seawall. The border wall, yeah. Glacial lake outbursts were perhaps more common at the end of the last ice age. There are some significant geological examples in the U.S. Pacific Northwest and British Columbia. Glacial dam collapses may figure into great flood legends in many civilizations around the world. In a sense, we are now seeing, or accelerating, the true end of the last ice age. And I have a reference that you can look at if you'd like. Okay, I think that that's been a chock-full show for an hour. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's Community Media, KPFT 90.1 FM HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, occasional bicker partner, and researcher is Andrew Ferguson, and I appreciate everything you do, Andrew. So I hope you've enjoyed the show. I hope perhaps you've learned something, and I hope you'll be with us again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late. We should be giving.
Relevant talk, information, and great music. This is Community Media, KPFT.
Well, if you are an animal lover, then BARC, the City of Houston's Animal Shelter and Adoption Center, would love to get to know you better for two reasons. First, for fostering, as fostering changes lives, and there's many different options within fostering, but with every kind of fostering, the goal is the same, to help every foster animal become adoptable and to find a forever home. To learn more about the life-saving act of fostering, shoot an email to barkfoster@houstontx.gov. The second thing to know about BARC is the large number of adorable animals looking for their forever homes. BARC's Adoption Center is open from noon to 5 p.m. Tuesdays through Sunday and is located at 3300 Carr Street, which is near 59 and Collinsworth. So if adoption or fostering works for your household lifestyle, please seek out more information at HoustonBARC.com.
It's 90.1 KPFT. Time to check in with the Ronnie and Tom Show.
That's the Tom and Ronnie Show?
Now stop that.
Doesn't everybody play Babaloo at least once a day?
So I was looking at the CD, and the title of it is The Best of Desi Arnaz. So is that a dozen different versions of Babaloo on there?
Join the fun and the great decades of music weekday afternoons, 2 to 4, here on KPFT.
I want you to turn your...